Bring up the bodies. Disc 7.
Now that Rafe is in the Privy Chamber, he has closer acquaintance with the musician Mark Smeaton, who has been promoted among the grooms. When Mark first showed himself at the Cardinal's door, he sloped up in patched boots and a canvas doublet that had belonged to a bigger man. The Cardinal put him into worsted, but since he joined the royal household, he goes in damask, perched on a fine gelding with a saddle of Spanish leather, the reins clutched in gold-fringed gloves. Where is the money coming from? Anne is recklessly generous, Rafe says. The gossip is that she has given Francis Weston a sum to keep his creditors at bay. You can understand, Rafe says, that because now the king does not admire the queen so much, she is keen to have young men about her who hang on her words. Her rooms are busy thoroughfares, the privy chamber gentlemen constantly calling in on this errand or that, and lingering to play a game or share a song. Where there is no message to carry, they invent one. Those gentlemen who are less in the Queen's favour are keen to talk to the newcomer and give him all the gossip, and some things he doesn't need to be told, he can see and hear for himself. Whispering and scuffling behind doors, covert mockery of the king, of his clothes, of his music, hints of his shortcomings in bed. Where would those hints come from but the Queen? There are some men who talk all the time about their horses. This is a steady mount, but I used to have one speedier. That's a fine filly you have there, but you shall see this bay I have my eye on. With Henry, it's ladies. He finds something to like in almost any female who crosses his path, and will scratch up a compliment for her, though she be plain and old and sour. With the young ones, he is enraptured twice a day. Has she not the finest eyes? Is not her throat white, her voice sweet, her hand shapely? Generally, it's look and don't touch. The most he will venture, blushing slightly, "Don't you think she must have pretty little duckies?" One day, Rafe hears Weston's voice in the next room, running on, amused, in imitation of the king.
"Has she not the wettest cunt you ever groped?"
Giggles, complicit sniggers, and,
"Hush, Cromwell's spies about."
Harry Norris has been absent from court lately, spending time on his own estates. When he is on duty, Rafe says, he tries to suppress the talk, sometimes seems angry at it, but sometimes he lets himself smile. They talk about the Queen, and they speculate. "Go on, Rafe," he says. Rafe doesn't like telling this. He feels it is below him to be an eavesdropper. He thinks hard before he speaks.
"The Queen needs to conceive another child quickly to please the King. But where is it to come from, they ask? Since Henry cannot be trusted to do the business, which of them is to do him a favour?"
"Did they come to any conclusion?" Rafe rubs the crown of his head and makes his hair stand up. "You know," he says, "they would not really do it. None of them. The Queen is sacred. It is too great a sin even for such lustful men as they be. And they are too much in fear of the king, surely, even though they mock him. Besides, she would not be so foolish." "I ask you again, did they come to any conclusion?"
"I think it's every man for himself."
He laughs. "Sauve qui peut." He hopes none of this will be needed. If he acts against Anne, he hopes for a cleaner way. It's all foolish talk. But Rafe cannot unhear it. He cannot unknow it. There it is. March weather. April weather. Icy showers and splinters of sun. He meets Chapuis indoors this time.
"You seem pensive, Master Secretary. Come to the fire."
He shakes away the raindrops from his hat. "I have a weight on my mind."
"Do you know? I think you only set up these meetings with me to annoy the French ambassador."
"Oh, yes," he sighs. "He is very jealous. In truth, I would visit you more often, except that word always gets back to the Queen, and she contrives to use it against me in one way or another."
"I could wish you a more gracious mistress."
The ambassador's implicit question, how is that going, the getting of a new mistress? Chapuis has floated to him, could there not be a new treaty between our sovereigns? Something that would safeguard Mary, her interests, perhaps place her back in the line of succession, after any children Henry might have with a new wife. Assuming, of course, the present queen were gone.
Ah, Lady Mary.
Lately he has taken to putting his hand to his hat when her name is mentioned. He can see the ambassador is touched by this. He can see him preparing to put it in dispatches. The king is willing to hold formal talks. It would please him to be united in friendship to the emperor. So much, he has said.
Now you must bring him to the point.
I have influence with the king, but I cannot answer for him. No subject can. This is my difficulty. To succeed with him, one must anticipate his desires, but one then stands exposed should he change his mind. Wolsey, his master, had advised, make him say what he wants. Do not guess, for by guessing you may destroy yourself. But perhaps, since Wolsey's day, the king's unexpressed commands have become harder to ignore. He fills the room with a seething discontent, stares up into the sky when you ask him to sign a paper, as if he were expecting deliverance.
You fear he will turn on you, Chapuis says.
He will, I suppose, one day. Sometimes he wakes in the night and thinks of it. There are courtiers who have honourably retired. He can think of instances. Of course, it is the other kind that loom larger if you are wakeful around midnight.
But if that day comes, the ambassador says, what will you do?
What can I do? Arm myself with patience and leave the rest to God, and hope the end is quick.
Your piety does you credit, Chapuis says. If fortune turns against you, you will need friends.
The Emperor would not spare a thought for me, Eustache. Or for any common man. No one raised a finger to help the Cardinal.
The poor Cardinal. I wish I had known him better.
Stop battering me up, he says sharply. Have done. Chapuis gives him a searching glance. The fire roars up, vapours rise from his clothes. The rain patters at the window. He shivers.
You are ill?
Chapuis inquires. No, I am not allowed to be. If I took to my bed, the Queen would turn me out of it and say I am faking. If you want to cheer me up, get out that Christmas hat of yours. It was a pity you had to put it away for mourning. Easter would be none too soon to see it again.
I think you are making jokes, Thomas, at the expense of my hat. I have heard that while it was in your custody, it was derided, not only by your clerks, but by your stable boys and dog keepers.
The reverse is true. There were many applications to try it on. I wish that we may see it at all major feasts of the church.
Once again, Chapuis says, your piety does you credit.
He sends Gregory away to his friend Richard Southwell to learn the art of speaking in public. It is good for him to get out of London, and to get away from the court, where the atmosphere is tense. All around him there are signs of unease, little huddles of courtiers that disperse at his approach. If he is to place all in hazard, and he thinks he is, then Gregory should not have to go through the pain and doubt, hour by hour. Let him hear the conclusion of events. He does not need to live through them. He had no time now to explain the world to the simple and the young. He has to watch the movements of cavalry and ordnance across Europe, and the ships on the seas, merchantmen and men of war, the influx of gold from the Americas to the treasury of the emperor. Sometimes peace looks like war. You cannot tell them apart. Sometimes these islands look very small. The word from Europe is that Mount Etna has erupted and brought floods throughout Sicily. In Portugal there is a drought, and everywhere envy and contention. Fear of the future, fear of hunger, or the fact of it, fear of God, and doubt over how to placate him, and in what language. The news, when he gets it, is always a fortnight out of date. The posts are slow, the tides against him. Just as the work of fortifying Dover is coming to an end, the walls of Calais are falling down. Frost has cracked the masonry and opened a fissure between Watergate and Lantern Gate. On Passion Sunday, a sermon is preached in the King's Chapel by Anne's almoner, John Skip. It appears to be an allegory. The force of it appears to be directed against him, Thomas Cromwell. He smiles broadly when those who attended explain it to him, sentence by sentence. His ill wishes and well wishes both. He is not a man to be knocked over by a sermon, or to feel himself persecuted by figures of speech. Once, when he was a boy, he had been in a rage against his father Walter and had rushed at him, intent to butt him in the belly with his head. But it was just before the Cornish rebels came swarming up the country, and as Putney reckoned it was in their line of march, Walter had been bashing out body armour for himself and his friends. So when he ran head first, there was a bang, which he heard before he felt it. Walter was trying on one of his creations.
"That'll teach you,"
his father said, phlegmatic. He often thinks about it, that iron belly, and he thinks he has got one, without the inconvenience and weight of metal. "Cromwell has plenty stomach," his friends say. His enemies, too. They mean he has appetite, gusto, attack. First thing in the morning or last thing at night, a bloody collop of meat would not disgust him, and if you wake him in the small hours, he is hungry then, too. An inventory comes in from Tilney Abbey. Vestments of red turkey satin and white lawn, wrought with beasts in gold. Two altar cloths of white Bruges satin, with drops like spots of blood made of red velvet. And the contents of the kitchen, weights, tongs, and fire forks, flesh hooks. Winter melts into spring. Parliament is dissolved. Easter Day. Lamb with ginger sauce. A blessed absence of fish. He remembers the eggs the children used to paint, giving each speckled shell a cardinal's hat. He remembers his daughter Anne, her hot little hand cupped around the eggshell so the colour ran.
"Look! Regardez!"
She was learning French that year. Then her amazed face, her curious tongue creeping out to lick the stain from her palm. The Emperor is in Rome, and the word is that he has had a 7-hour meeting with the Pope. How much of that was devoted to plotting against England? Or did the Emperor speak up for his brother monarch? It is rumoured there will be an accord between the Emperor and the French. Bad news for England, if so. Time to push on with negotiations. He sets up a meeting between Chapuis and Henry. A letter is sent to him from Italy, which begins, "Molto magnifico, signor." He remembers Hercules, the labourer. 2 days after Easter, the imperial ambassador is welcomed at court by George Boleyn. At the sight of glinting George, teeth and pearl buttons flashing, the ambassador's eye rolls like the eye of a startled horse. He has been received by George before, but he did not expect him today. Rather one of his own friends, perhaps Carew. George addresses him at length in his elegant and courtly French. "You will please to hear Mass with His Majesty, and then, if you will do me the favour, it will be my pleasure to entertain you personally to 10 o'clock dinner." Chapuis is looking around. "Cromwell, help!" He stands back, smiling, watching the operations of George. "I'll miss him," he thinks, "in the days when it is all over for him. When I kick him back to Kent to count his sheep and take a homely interest in the grain harvest." The king himself gives Chapuis a smile, a gracious word. He, Henry, sails to his private closet above. Chapuis disposes himself amid George's hangers-on.
"Judicat me, Deus," intones the priest. "Judge me, O God, and separate my cause from the nation that is not holy. Deliver me from the unjust and deceitful man."
Chapuis now turns around and stabs him with a look. He grins.
"Why art thou sad, O my soul?" asks the priest.
In Latin, of course. As the ambassador shuffles towards the altar to receive the sacred host, the gentlemen around him, neat as practiced dancers, hesitate half a pace and fall behind him. Chapuis falters. George's friends have surrounded him. He darts a glance over his shoulder. Where am I? What should I do? At that moment, and exactly in his line of sight, Anne the Queen sweeps down from her own private galleried space, head high, velvet and sables, rubies at her throat. Chapuis hesitates. He cannot go forward, for he is afraid to cross her path. He cannot go back, because George and his minions are pressing him. Anne turns her head, a pointed smile, and to the enemy she makes a reverence, a gracious inclination of her jeweled neck. Chapuis screws up his eyes tight and bows to the concubine. After all these years he has picked his path so that never, never was he brought face to face with her, never brought to this stark choice, to this damnable politesse. But what else could he do? It will soon be reported. It will get back to the Emperor. Let us hope and pray that Charles will understand. All this shows on the ambassador's face. He, Cromwell, kneels and takes communion. God turns to paste on his tongue. While this process occurs, it is reverent to close the eyes, but on this singular occasion God will forgive him for looking about. He sees George Boleyn pink with pleasure. He sees Chapuis white with humiliation. He sees Henry dazzle in gold as he descends ponderous from the gallery. The king's tread is deliberate. His step is slow. His face is blazing with solemn triumph. Despite the best efforts of Pearly George, as they leave the chapel, the ambassador breaks away. He scurries towards him, then his hand fastens with a terrier grip.
Cromwell, you know this was planned. How could you so embarrass me?
It is for the best, I assure you. He adds, somber, thoughtful, what use as a diplomat would you be, Eustache, if you did not understand the character of princes? They do not think as other men think. To commoners' minds like ours, Henry seems perverse. Light dawns in the ambassador's eye.
Ah!
He lets out a long breath. He grasps, in that single moment, why Henry has forced him to make a public reverence to a queen whom he no longer wants. Henry is tenacious of his will. He is stubborn. Now he has carried his point. His second marriage has been acknowledged. Now, if he likes, he can let it go. Chapuis draws his garments together, as if he feels a draught from the future. He whispers,
"Must I really dine with her brother?"
Oh, yes. You will find him a charming host. After all, he raises a hand to hide his smile. Has he not just enjoyed a triumph? He and his whole family? Chapuis huddles closer.
I am shocked to see her. I have not seen her so close. She looks like a thin old woman. Was that Mistress Seymour in the halcyon sleeves? She is very plain. What does Henry see in her?
He thinks she's stupid. He finds it restful.
Clearly he is enamoured. There must be something about her not evident to the stranger's eye.
The ambassador sniggers.
No doubt she has a very fine enigme.
No one would know, he says blankly. She is a virgin.
After so long at your court? Surely Henry is deluded.
Ambassador, keep this for later. Your host is here. Chapuis folds his hands over his heart. He makes George Lord Rochford a sweeping bow. Lord Rochford does the same. Arm in arm, they mince away. It sounds as if Lord Rochford is reciting verses in praise of the spring. Says Lord Audley.
What a performance.
The weak sunshine glints from the Lord Chancellor's chain of office.
Come on, my boy. Let's go and gnaw a crust,
Audley chuckles.
The poor ambassador. He looks like someone being carried by slavers to the Barbary coast. He does not know what country he will wake up in tomorrow.
Nor do I, he thinks.
You can rely on Audley to be jovial.
He closes his eyes. Some hint, some intimation has reached him that he has had the best of the day, though it is only 10 o'clock.
Crumb,
the Lord Chancellor says. It is some time after dinner that it all begins to fall apart, and in the worst possible way. He has left Henry and the ambassador together in a window embrasure, to caress each other with words, to coo about an alliance, to make each other immodest propositions. It is the king's change of colour he notices first. Pink and white to brick red. Then he hears Henry's voice, high-pitched, cutting.
I think you presume too much, Chapuis. You say I acknowledge your master's right to rule in Milan, but perhaps the King of France has as good a right or better. Do not presume to know my policy, Ambassador.
Chapuis jumps back. He thinks of Jane Seymour's question. Master Secretary, have you ever seen a scalded cat? The ambassador speaks, something low and supplicating. Henry raps back at him.
Do you mean to say that what I took as a courtesy from one Christian prince to the other is really a bargaining position? You agree to bow to my wife, the Queen, and then you send me a bill?
He, Cromwell, sees Chapuis hold up a placating hand. The ambassador is trying to interrupt, to limit the damage. But Henry talks over him, audible to the whole chamber, to the whole gaping assembly, and to those pressing in behind.
Does your master not remember what I did for him in his early troubles, when his Spanish subjects rose up against him? I kept the seas open for him. I lent him money. And what do I get back?
A pause. Chapuis has to send his mind scurrying back to the years before he was in post.
The money? He suggests weakly.
Nothing but broken promises. Recall, if you will, how I helped him against the French. He promised me territory. Next thing I heard, he was making a treaty with Francis. Why should I trust a word he says?
Chapuis draws himself up, as far as a little man can.
Game, little cockerel,
Audley says in his ear. But he, Cromwell, is not to be distracted. His eyes are fastened on the king. He hears Chapuis say,
Majesty, that is not a question to be asked by one prince of another.
Is it not? Henry snarls. In times past, I would never have had to ask it. I take every brother prince to be honourable as I am honourable. But sometimes, monsieur, I suggest to you, our fond and natural assumptions must give way before bitter experience. I ask you, does your master take me for a fool?
Henry's voice swoops upwards. He bends at the waist and his fingers make little paddling motions on his knees, as if he were trying to entice a child or a small dog.
Henry! He squeaks. Come to Charles! Come to your kind master!
He straightens up, almost spitting in his rage.
The Emperor treats me like an infant! First he whips me, then he pets me, then it is a whip again. Tell him I am not an infant. Tell him I am an emperor in my own realm, and a man and a father. Tell him to keep out of my family business. I have put up with his interference for too long. First he seeks to tell me who I can marry. Then he wants to show me how to manage my daughter. Tell him I shall deal with Mary as I see fit, as a father does deal with a disobedient child, no matter who her mother is.
The king's hand, in fact, dear God, his fist, makes crude contact with the ambassador's shoulder. His path cleared, Henry stamps out. An imperial performance. Except that his leg drags. He shouts over his shoulder,
I require a profound and public apology.
He, Cromwell, lets out his breath. The ambassador fizzes across the room, gibbering. Distraught, he seizes his arm.
Cromwell, I do not know for what I am to apologize. I come here in good faith. I am tricked into coming face to face with that creature. I am forced to exchange compliments with her brother through a whole dinner. And then I am attacked by Henry. He wants my master. He needs my master. He is just playing the old game, trying to sell himself dear, pretending he might send troops to King Francis to fight in Italy. Where are these troops? I do not see them. I have eyes. I do not see his army.
Peace, peace, Audley soothes.
We will do the apologizing, monsieur. Let him cool down. Never fear. Hold back your dispatches to your good master. Do not write tonight. We will keep the talks going.
Over Audley's shoulder, he sees Edward Seymour gliding through the crowd. Ah, ambassador, he says, with a suave confidence he does not feel. Here is an opportunity for you to meet... Edward springs forward.
Mon cher ami!
Black glances from Boleyn's. Edward into the breach, armed with confident French, sweeping Chapuis aside. None too soon. A stir at the door. The king is back, erupting into the midst of the gentlemen.
Cromwell!
Henry stops before him. He is breathing hard.
Make him understand. It is not for the Emperor to make conditions to me. It is for the Emperor to apologize for threatening me with war.
His face congests.
Cromwell, I know just what you have done. You have gone too far in this matter. What have you promised him? Whatever it is, you have no authority.
You have put my honour in hazard.
But what do I expect? How can a man like you understand the honour of princes?
You have said, oh, I am sure of Henry, I have the king in my pocket. Don't deny it, Cromwell, I can hear you saying it.
You mean to train me up, don't you? Like one of your boys at Austin Friars, touch my cap when you come down of a morning and say, how do you, sir? Walk through Whitehall half a pace behind you, carry your folios, your inkhorn and your seal, and why not a crown, eh, brought behind you in a leather bag?
Henry is convulsing with rage.
I really believe, Cromwell, that you think you are king, and I am the blacksmith's boy.
He will never claim later that his heart did not turn over. He is not one to boast of a coolness no reasonable man would possess. Henry could at any moment gesture to his guards. He could find himself with cold metal at his ribs and his day done. But he steps back. He knows his face shows nothing, neither repentance, nor regret, nor fear. He thinks, you could never be the blacksmith's boy. Walter would not have had you in his forge. Brawn is not the whole story. In the flames you need a cool head. When sparks are flying to the rafters, you must note when they fall on you and knock the fire away with one swat of your hard palm. A man who panics is no use in a shop full of molten metal. And now, as Monarch's sweating face thrust into his, he remembers something his father told him. If you burn your hand, Tom, raise your hands and cross your wrists before you, and hold them so till you get to the water or the salve. I don't know how it works, but it confuses the pain, and then if you utter a prayer at the same time, you might get off not too bad. He raises his palms. He crosses his wrists. Back you go, Henry. As if confused by the gesture, as if almost relieved to be stopped, the king ceases ranting, and he backs off a pace, turning his face away and so relieving him, Cromwell, of that bloodshot stare, of the indecent closeness of the popping blue whites of the king's eyes. He says softly, God preserve you, Majesty. And now, will you excuse me? So, whether he will excuse or no, he walks away. He walks into the next room. You have heard the expression, my blood was boiling. His blood is boiling. He crosses his wrists. He sits down on a chest and calls for a drink. When it is fetched, he takes into his right hand the cool pewter cup, running the pads of his fingers around its curves. The wine is strong claret. He spills a drop. He blots it with his forefinger, and for neatness touches it with his tongue so it vanishes. He cannot say whether the trick has decreased the pain, as Walter said it would, but he is glad his father is with him. Someone must be. He looks up. Chapuis's face is hovering over him, smiling, a mask of malice.
My dear friend, I thought your last hour had come. Do you know, I thought you would forget yourself and hit him.
He looks up and smiles. I never forget myself. What I do, I mean to do.
Though you may not mean what you say.
He thinks the ambassador has suffered cruelly just for doing his job. In addition, I have injured his feelings. I have been ironical about his hat. Tomorrow I shall organize him a present, a horse of some magnificence, a horse for his own riding. I myself, before it departs my stables, will lift a hoof and check the shoe. The king's council meets next day. Wiltshire, or Monseigneur, is present. The Boleyns are sleek cats, lolling in their seats and preening their whiskers. Their kinsman, the Duke of Norfolk, looks ragged, unnerved. He stops him on the way in. Stops him, Cromwell.
All right, lad.
Was ever the Master of the Rolls so addressed? By the Earl Marshal of England? In the council chamber, Norfolk scuffles the stools about, creaks down on one that suits him.
That's what he does, you know.
He flashes him a grin, a glimpse of fang.
You're balanced just so, standing on your feet. Then he blows the pavement from under you.
He nods, smiling patiently. Henry comes in, sits like a great sulky baby on a chair at the head of the table, meets no one's eyes. Now, He hopes his colleagues know their duties. He has told them often enough. Flatter Henry. Beseech Henry. Implore him to do what you know he must do anyway. So Henry feels he has a choice. So he feels a warm regard for himself, as if he is not consulting his own interests, but yours. Majesty, the councillors say, if it please you, to look favourably, for the sake of the realm and commonweal, on the Emperor's slavish overtures, on his whimpers and pleas. This occupies 15 minutes. At last Henry says, "Well, if it is for the good of the commonweal, I will receive Chapuis. We will continue negotiations. I must swallow, I suppose, any personal insults I have received." Norfolk leans forward.
"Think of it like a draught of medicine, Henry. Bitter. But for the sake of England, do not spit."
The subject of physicians once raised, the marriage of the Lady Mary is discussed. She continues to complain, wherever the king moves her, of bad air, insufficient food, insufficient consideration of her privacy, of dolorous limb pains, headaches, and heaviness of spirit. Her doctors have advised that congress with a man would be good for her health. If a young woman's vital spirits are bottled up, she becomes pale and thin, her appetite wanes, she begins to waste. Marriage is an occupation for her, she forgets her minor ailments. Her womb remains anchored and primed for use, and shows no tendency to go wandering about her body as if it had nothing better to do. In default of a man, the Lady Mary needs strenuous exercise on horseback. Difficult for someone under house arrest. Henry clears his throat at last and speaks.
"The Emperor, it is no secret, has discussed Mary with his own councillors. He would like her married out of this realm to one of his relatives within his own domains."
His lips tighten.
"In no wise will I suffer her to go out of the country, or indeed to go anywhere at all, while her behaviour to me is not what it ought to be."
He, Cromwell, says, "Her mother's death is still raw with her. I have no doubt she will see her duty over these next weeks."
"How pleasing to hear from you at last, Cromwell," says Monseigneur with a smirk. "You do most usually speak first and last and everywhere in the middle, so that we more modest councillors are obliged to speak sotto voce, if at all, and pass notes to each other. May we ask if this new reticence of yours relates in any way to yesterday's events, when His Majesty, if I do recall correctly, administered a check to your ambition?"
"Thank you for that," the Lord Chancellor says flatly. "My Lord Wiltshire."
The King says,
"My Lords, the subject is my daughter. I am sorry to have to recall you, though I am far from sure she should be discussed in council."
"Myself," Norfolk says, "I would go up country to Mary and make her swear the oath. I would plant her hand on the gospel and hold it there flat, and if she would not take her oath to the King and to my niece's child, I would beat her head against the wall till it were as soft as a baked apple."
"And thank you again," Audley says, "my Lord Norfolk."
"Anyway," the King says sadly, "we have not so many children that we can well afford to lose one out of the kingdom. I would rather not part with her. One day she will be a good daughter to me."
The Boleyns sit back, smiling. Hearing the King say he seeks no great foreign match for Mary, she is of no importance, a bastard whom one considers only out of charity. They are well content with the triumph afforded them yesterday by the imperial ambassador, and they are showing their good taste by not boasting about it. As soon as the meeting ends, he, Cromwell, is mobbed by the councillors, except for the Boleyns, who waft off in the other direction. The meeting has gone well. He has got everything he wants. Henry is back on course for a treaty with the Emperor. Why then does he feel so restless, stifled? He elbows his colleagues aside, though in a mannerly fashion. He wants air. Henry passes him. He stops. He turns. He says,
"Master Secretary, will you walk along with me?"
They walk. In silence. It is for the Prince, not the Minister, to introduce a topic. He can wait. Henry says,
"You know, I wish we would go down to the Weald one day, as we have said, to talk to the Ironmasters."
He waits.
I have had various drawings, mathematical drawings, and advices concerning how our ordnance can be improved, but to be truthful, I cannot make as much of it as you would.
More humble, he thinks. A little more humble yet. Henry says,
You have been in the forest and met charcoal burners. I remember you said to me once, they be very poor men.
He waits.
Henry says, One must know the process from the beginning, I think, whether one is making armour or ordnance. It is no use demanding of a metal that it has certain properties, a certain temper, unless you know how it is made, and the difficulties your craftsman may encounter. Now, I have never been too proud to sit down for an hour with a gauntlet maker who armours my right hand. We must study, I think, every pin, every rivet.
And? Yes? He leaves the king to stumble on.
And, well, and so, you are my right hand, sir.
He nods. Sir, how touching. Henry says,
So, to Kent, to the Weald, will we go? Shall I choose a week? 2-3 days should do it.
He smiles. Not this summer, sir. You will be engaged otherwise. Besides, the ironmasters are like all of us. They must have a holiday. They must lie in the sun. They must pick apples. Henry looks at him, mild, beseeching, from the tail of his blue eye. Give me a happy summer.
He says, I cannot live as I have lived, Cromwell.
He is here to take instructions. Get me Jane. Jane, so kind, who sighs across the palate like sweet butter. Deliver me from bitterness, from gall. I think I might go home, he says, if you will permit. I have much to do if I am to set this affair in train, and I feel his English deserts him. This sometimes happens. Un peu. But his French deserts him too.
But you are not ill. You will be back soon.
I shall seek a consultation with the canon lawyers, he says. It may take some days. You know what they are. It will go no slower than I can help. I shall speak to the Archbishop.
And perhaps to Harry Percy,
Henry says.
You know how she... the betrothal, the whatever, the relationship between them. Well, I think they were as good as married, were they not? And if that won't run...
He rubs his beard.
You know that I was... Before I was with the Queen, I was on occasion with her sister Mary, which...
Oh, yes, sir. I remember Mary Boleyn.
And it will be seen that, having been linked with kin so near to Anne, I could not make a valid marriage to her. However, you will only use that if you have to. I do not want unnecessary...
He nods. You don't want history to make a liar of you. In public, before your courtiers, you had me state that you had never had to do with Mary Boleyn, while you sat there and nodded. You removed all impediments. Mary Boleyn, Harry Percy, you swept them aside. But now our requirements have changed, and the facts have changed behind us.
So fare you well, Henry says. A very secret. I trust in your discretion and your skill.
How necessary, but how sad to hear Henry apologize. He has developed a perverse respect for Norfolk, with his grunt of, All right, lad. In an antechamber, Mr. Risley is waiting for him.
So do you have instructions, sir?
Well, I have hints.
Do you know when they might take form?
He smiles.
Call me, says, I hear that in council the king declared he will seek to marry Lady Mary to a subject.
Surely that's not what the meeting concluded. In a moment he feels like himself again, hears himself laughing and saying, Oh, for Christ's sake, call me. Who told you that? Sometimes, he says, I think it will save time and work if all the interested parties came to the council, including foreign ambassadors. The proceedings leak out anyway, and to save them mishearing and misconstruing, they might as well hear everything at first hand.
I've got it wrong, then, Risley says. Because I thought marrying her to a subject, to some low man, that was a plan thought up by the queen that is now.
He shrugs. The young man gives him a glassy look. It will be some years before he understands why.
Edward Seymour seeks an interview with him. There is no doubt in his mind that the Seymours will come to his table, even if they have to sit under it and catch the crumbs. Edward is tense, hurried, nervous. Master Secretary, taking the long view in this matter, a day would be a long view. Get your girl out of it. Let Carew take her to his house down in Surrey. Do not think I wish to know your secrets, Edward says, picking his words. Do not think I wish to pry into matters that are not for me. But for my sister's sake, I would like to have some indication. Oh, I see. You want to know if she should order her wedding clothes. Edward gives him an imploring look. He says soberly, We are going to seek an annulment. Just now I do not know on what grounds. But they will fight, Edward says. The Boleyns, if they go down, will take us with them. I have heard of serpents that, though they are dying, exude poison through their skins. Did you ever pick up a snake? He asks. I did once, in Italy. He holds out his palms. I am unmarked. Then we must be very secret, Edward says. Anne must not know. Well, he says wryly, I do not think we can keep it from her forever. But she will know all the sooner, if his new friends do not stop trapping him in anterooms, blocking his path and bowing to him, if they do not stop this whispering and eyebrow-raising and digging each other with their elbows. He says to Edward, I must go home and shut the door and consult with myself. The Queen is plotting something, I know not what, something devious, something dark, perhaps so dark that she herself does not know what it is, and as yet is only dreaming of it. But I must be quick. I must dream it for her. I shall dream it into being. According to Lady Rochford, Anne complains that since she rose from childbed, Henry is always watching her, and not in the way he used to. For a long time he has noticed Harry Norris watching the Queen, and from some eminence, perched like a carved falcon over a doorway, he has seen himself watching Harry Norris. For now, Anne seems oblivious to the wings that hover over her, to the eye that studies her path as she jinks and swerves. She chatters about her child Elizabeth, holding up on her fingers a tiny cap, a pretty ribboned cap, just come from the embroiderer. Henry looks at her flatly, as if to say, Why are you showing me this? What is it to me? Anne strokes the scrap of silk. He feels a needle point of pity, an instant of compunction. He studies the fine silk braid that edges the Queen's sleeve. Some woman with the skills of his dead wife made that braid. He is looking very closely at the Queen. He feels he knows her as a mother knows her child, or a child its mother. He knows every stitch in her bodice. He notes the rise and fall of her every breath. What is in your heart, madam? That is the last door to be opened. Now he stands on the threshold, and the key is in his hand, and he is almost afraid to fit it into the lock. Because what if it doesn't? What if it doesn't fit, and he has to fumble there with Henry's eyes on him, hear the impatient click of the royal tongue as surely his master Wolsey once heard it? Well, then. There was an occasion in Bruges, was it, when he had broken down a door? He wasn't in the habit of breaking doors, but he had a client who wanted results and wanted them today. Locks can be picked, but that's for the adept with time to spare. You don't need skill, and you don't need time if you've got a shoulder and a boot. He thinks, I wasn't 30 then. I was a youth. Absently, his right hand rubs his left shoulder, his forearm, as if remembering the bruises. He imagines himself entering Anne, not as a lover, but as a lawyer, and rolled in his fist his papers, his writ. He imagines himself entering the heart of the Queen. In its chambers, he hears the click of his own boot heels. At home, he takes from his chest the Book of Hours that belonged to his wife. It was given to her by her first husband, Tom Williams, who was a good enough fellow, but not a man of substance like himself. Whenever he thinks of Tom Williams now, it is as a blank, a faceless, waiting man dressed in the Cromwell livery, holding his coat, or perhaps his horse. Now that he can handle, at his whim, the finest texts in the King's library, the prayer book seems a poor thing. Where is the gold leaf? Yet the essence of Elizabeth is in this book, his poor wife with her white cap her blunt manner, her sideways smile and busy craftswoman's fingers. Once he had watched Liz making a silk braid. One end was pinned to the wall, and on each finger of her raised hands she was spinning loops of thread, her fingers flying so fast he couldn't see how it worked. "Slow down," he said, "so I can see how you do it." But she'd laughed and said, "I can't slow down. If I stopped to think how I was doing it, I couldn't do it at all." Chapter 2. Master of Phantoms. London, April to May 1536. "Come and sit with me a while."
"Why?"
Lady Worcester is wary.
"Because I have cakes."
She smiles.
"I am greedy."
"I even have a waiter to serve them."
She eyes Christoph.
"This boy is a waiter?"
"Christoph, first Lady Worcester requires a cushion."
The cushion is plump with down and embroidered with a pattern of hawks and flowers. She takes it in her two hands, strokes it absently, then positions it behind her and leans back.
"Oh, that's better,"
she smiles. Pregnant, she rests a composed hand on her belly like a Madonna in a painting. In this small room, its window open to mild spring air, he is holding a court of inquiry. He does not mind who comes in to see him, who is noticed as they come and go. Who would not pass the time with a man who has cakes? And Master Secretary is always pleasant and useful.
"Christoph, hand my lady a napkin and go and sit in the sun for 10 minutes. Close the door behind you."
Lady Worcester, Elizabeth, watches the door close. Then she leans forward and whispers,
"Master Secretary, I'm in such trouble."
"And this," he indicates her person, "cannot be easy. Is the Queen jealous of your condition?"
"Well, she keeps me close to her, and she need not. She asks me each day how I do. I could not have a fonder mistress."
But her face shows doubt.
"In some ways it would be better if I were to go home to the country. As it is, kept before the court, I am pointed at by all."
"Do you think, then, it is the Queen herself who began the murmurs against you?"
"Who else?"
A rumour is going about the court that Lady Worcester's baby is not the Earl's child. Perhaps it was spread out of malice. Perhaps as someone's idea of a joke. Perhaps because someone was bored. Her gentle brother, the courtier Anthony Brown, has stormed into her rooms to take her to task.
"I told him," she says, "don't pick on me. Why me?"
As if sharing her indignation, the curd tart on her palm quakes in its pastry shell. He frowns.
"Let me take you back a step. Is your family blaming you because people are talking about you, or because there is truth in what they say?"
Lady Worcester dabs her lips.
"Do you think I will confess just for cakes?"
"Let me smooth this over for you. I should like to help you if I can. Has your husband reason to be angry?"
"Oh, men," she says, "they are always angry. They are so angry they can't count on their fingers."
"So it could be the Earl's."
"If it is a strong boy, I dare say he will own it."
The cakes are distracting her.
"That white one, is that almond cream?"
Lady Worcester's brother, Anthony Brown, is Fitzwilliam's half-brother. All these people are related to each other. Luckily, the Cardinal left him a chart which he updates whenever there is a wedding. Fitzwilliam and Brown and the aggrieved Earl have been conferring in corners. And Fitzwilliam has said to him, "Can you find out, Crumb, for I am sure I cannot, what the devil is going on among the Queen's waiting women?"
"And then there's the debts," he says to her. "You are in a sad place, my lady. You have borrowed from everyone. What did you buy? I know there are sweet young men about the King, witty young men too, always amorous and ready to write a lady a letter. Do you pay to be flattered?"
"No, to be complimented."
"You should get that free."
"I believe that is gallant speech." She licks her fingers. "But you are a man of the world, Master Secretary, and you know that if you yourself wrote a woman a poem, you would enclose a bill." He laughs.
"True. I know the value of my time. But I did not think your admirers were so miserly."
"But they have so much to do, these boys."
She selects a candied violet, nibbles it.
I do not know why we speak of idle youths. They are busy day and night, making their careers. They wouldn't send their account in, but you must buy them a jewel for their cap, or some gilt buttons for a sleeve. Fee their tailor, perhaps.
He thinks of Mark Smeaton in his finery. Does the Queen pay out in this way?
We call it patronage. We don't call it paying out.
I accept your correction. Jesus, he thinks, a man could use a whore and call it patronage. Lady Worcester has dropped some raisins on the table, and he feels the urge to pick them up and feed them to her. Probably that will be all right with her. So when the Queen is a patron, does she ever patronize in private?
In private? How could I know?
He nods. It's tennis, he thinks. That shot was too good for me. What does she wear to patronize?
I have not myself seen her naked.
So you think these flatterers, you don't think she goes to it with them?
Not in my sight or hearing.
But behind a closed door?
Doors are often closed. It is a common thing.
If I were to ask you to bear witness, would you repeat that on oath? She flicks a speck of cream away.
The doors are often closed. I could go so far.
And what would be your fee for that?
He is smiling. His eyes rest on her face. I am a little afraid of my husband, because I have borrowed money. He does not know, so please, hush.
Point your creditors in my direction, and for the future, if you need a compliment, draw on the Bank of Cromwell. We look after our customers, and our terms are generous. We are known for it. She puts down her napkin, picks a last primrose petal from the last cheesecake. She turns at the door. A thought has struck her. Her hand bunches her skirts.
The king wants a reason to put her aside, yes? And the closed door will be enough? I would not wish her harm.
She grasps the situation, at least partly. Caesar's wife must be above reproach. Suspicion would ruin the queen. A crumb or a sliver of truth would ruin her faster. You wouldn't need a bedsheet with a snail trail left by Francis Weston or some other sonneteer. Put her aside, he says. Yes, possibly, unless these rumours prove to be misunderstandings, as I'm sure they will in your case. I am sure your husband will be contented when the child is born. Her face clears.
So you will speak to him, but not about the debt, and speak to my brother, and William Fitzwilliam? You will persuade them to leave me alone, please? There is nothing I have done that other ladies have not.
Mistress Shelton, he says.
That would be no news.
Mistress Seymour?
That would be news indeed.
Lady Rochford?
She hesitates. Jane Rochford does not like the sport.
Why? Is my Lord Rochford inept?
Inept.
She seems to taste the word.
I have not heard her describe it like that.
She smiles.
But I have heard her describe it.
Christoph is back. She sails past him, a woman disburdened.
Oh, look at that,
Christoph says.
She has picked all the petals off the top and left the crumb.
Christoph sits down to stuff his maw with the remnants. He craves honey, sugar. You can never mistake a boy who was brought up hungry. We are coming to the sweet season of the year, when the air is mild and the leaves pale, and lemon cakes are flavoured with lavender, egg custards barely set, infused with a sprig of basil, elderflowers simmered in a sugar syrup, and poured over halved strawberries. St. George's Day. All over England, cloth and paper dragons sway in noisy procession through the streets, and the dragon slayer after them in his armour of tin, beating an old rusty sword on his shield. Virgins plait wreaths of leaves, and spring flowers are carried into church. In the hall at Austin Friars, Antony has hung from the ceiling beams a beast with green scales, a rolling eye and a lolling tongue. It looks lascivious and reminds him of something, but he can't remember what. This is the day the Garter Knights hold their chapter, where they elect a new knight if any member has died. The Garter is the most distinguished order of chivalry in Christendom. The King of France is a member.
so is the King of Scots, so is Monseigneur the Queen's father, and the King's bastard Harry Fitzroy. This year the meeting is at Greenwich. The foreign members will not attend, it is understood, and yet the chapter serves as a gathering of his new allies. William Fitzwilliam, Henry Courtenay, the Marquess of Exeter, my Lord of Norfolk, and Charles Brandon, who seems to have forgiven him, Thomas Cromwell, for shoving him around the presence chamber, who now seeks him out and says,
"Cromwell, we have had our differences, but I always did say to Harry Tudor, now take note of Cromwell, let him not go down with his ingrate master, for Wolsey has taught him his tricks, and it may be useful to you accordingly."
"Did you so, my lord? I am much bound to you for that word."
"Aye, well, we see the consequence, for now you are a rich man, are you not?"
He chuckles.
"And so is Harry rich."
"And I am always glad to bestow gratitude in the proper quarter. May I ask, who will my lord vote for in the Garter chapter?" Brandon gives him a strenuous wink.
"Depend on me."
There is one vacancy, caused by the death of Lord Begaveni. There are two men who expect to have it. Anne has been pressing the merits of Brother George. The other candidate is Nicholas Carew. And when soundings have been taken and the votes have been counted, it is Sir Nicholas whose name is read out by the King. George's people are quick to limit the damage, to give out that they didn't expect anything, that Carew was promised the next vacancy, that King Francis himself asked the King 3 years ago to give it him. If the Queen is displeased, she does not show it, and the King and George Boleyn have a project to discuss. The day after May Day, a royal party is to ride down to Dover to inspect the new work on the harbour, and George will accompany it in his capacity as warden of the Cinque Ports, an office which he fills badly, in his Cromwell's opinion. He himself plans to ride down with the King. He could even go over to Calais for a day or two and order matters there. So he gives out, the rumour of his arrival serving to keep the garrison on the qui-vive. Harry Percy has come down from his own country for the Garter meeting, and is now at his house at Stoke Newington. "That might be useful," he says to his nephew Richard. "I might send someone to see him and sound him out, whether he might be prepared to give back word on this pre-contract business. Go myself if I need to. But we must take this week hour by hour." Richard Sampson is waiting for him. Dean of the Chapel Royal, Doctor of Canon Law, Cambridge, Paris, Perugia, Siena, the King's proctor in his first divorce.
"Here is a pretty pickle," is all the Dean will say, laying down his folios in his precise way.
There is a mule cart outside, groaning with further folios, well wrapped to save them from adverse weather. The documents go all the way back to the King's first expressed dissatisfaction with his first queen. "At which time," he says to the Dean, "we were all young." Samson laughs. It is a clerical laugh, like the creak of a vestment chest.
"I barely recall being young, but I suppose we were, and some of us carefree."
They are going to try for nullity, see if Henry can be released.
"I hear Harry Percy bursts into tears at the sound of your name," Samson says.
"They much exaggerate. The Earl and I have had many civil interchanges these last months." He keeps turning over papers from the first divorce, and finding the Cardinal's hand, amending, suggesting, drawing arrows in the margin. "Unless," he says, "and the Queen would decide to enter religion, then the marriage would be dissolved of itself."
"I'm sure she would make an excellent abbess," Samson says politely. "Have you sounded out my Lord Archbishop yet?"
Cranmer is away. He has been putting it off. "I have to show him," he tells the Dean, "that our cause, that is to say, the cause of the English Bible, will get on better without her. We want the living word of God to sound in the King's ears like music, not like Anne's ingrate whining." He says we, including the Dean out of courtesy. He is not at all sure that in his heart Samson is devoted to reform, but it is outward compliance that concerns him, and the Dean is always cooperative.
"This little matter of sorcery," Samson clears his throat, "the King does not mean us to pursue it seriously. If it could be proved that some unnatural means were used to draw him into the marriage, then of course his consent could not be free,
The contract is of no effect.
But surely, when he says he was seduced by charms, by spells, he was speaking, as it were, in figures, as a poet might speak of a lady's fair charms, her wiles, her seductions?
Oh, by the mass, the dean says mildly. Do not look at me in that way, Thomas Cromwell. It is a business I would rather not meddle in. I would rather have Harry Percy again, and between us beat him into sense. I would rather bring out the matter of Mary Boleyn, whose name, I must say, I hoped never to hear again.
He shrugs. He sometimes thinks about Mary. What it would have been like if he had taken her up on her offers. That night in Calais, he had been so close he could taste her breath, sweetmeats and spices, wine.
But, of course, that night in Calais, any man with functioning tackle would have done for Mary. Gently, the dean breaks into his train of thought.
May I suggest? Go and talk to the Queen's father. Talk to Wiltshire. He's a reasonable man. We were at Bilbao together on embassy a few years back. I always found him to be reasonable. Get him to ask his daughter to go quietly. Save us all 20 years of grief.
This ends Disc 7.